Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today, we have Aaron Stachel. Aaron is a partner with First Mile Ventures. Aaron, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Glad to have you on. So why don't we start with First Mile? Would love to know the firm's investment thesis.
Yeah, so we got started in Colorado about 10 years ago. We had seen my partner Bill was investing as an angel. He's a founder who took a company public and was a bit of a pioneer in cloud storage and was investing personally after his IPO and just saw the rise of Colorado as an ecosystem and kind of the rise of Seed as a stage, you know, a dedicated stop on the way to Series A. And it's like, you know, I'm writing these angel checks, but there's really nobody here to fill out these seed rounds. And, they're not in a material way, at least. And so he saw that opportunity, was looking for somebody to help him. I was in the right place at the right time. And so we raised our first fund in 2014, really with a goal in filling that gap in Colorado. And so, for us, our mission is to be the first partner to founders building generational companies in the fastest growing markets sort of outside the coast. And you know, right now we have partners in Colorado and Texas. And so we have a geographic thesis that you can build great companies anywhere. And that at the pre-seed sort of first check stage, you know, you're best served with a local partner. You know, once you have a company up and running and things are working, bigger investors are happy to fly in and do the next round. But, you know, we want to be that first partner that gets them into the market.
Great. Okay, so a bunch to talk about. We'll start with the geography, and you mentioned the coasts. So late last week, Carta had published valuations at Series A across the country, and I think a bit intuitive, Bay Area led the charge. And so as a consequence, you know, I've historically known that you have a lot of LPs who are gravitate towards funds that are focused on geography for purposes of servicing more value. You know, what's the extent that you found that that's served as a benefit to First Mile and your investors?
Yeah, I would say it's sort of ebbed and flowed. You know, when we first started 10 years ago, it was, you know, I think people on the coast especially were dismissive of sort of the interior of the country. When we were raising our first fund, it's like, oh, a Colorado focused fund. That's cute. You know, we got lots of interesting stuff in our backyard, but, you know, go after it. And I think there was a perception that if you started a company in a place like Colorado, eventually you would have to move to the coast to get the talent and capital you need to scale. And we were, you know, on the ground sort of seeing founders, you know, great founders wanting to build big companies. And that sort of stereotype of, you know, people only move to Colorado if they want to leave work early and go ride their mountain bike, you know, was just not true. You know, it's a great place to do business as well. And so we saw that and were able to, you know, raise a small fund, invest in companies that are not, you know, there's a half a dozen sort of privately held multi-billion dollar companies in Colorado that were started around that time. And we're fortunate to be in at least one of them. And, you know, so there was this initial skepticism. And then when we started raising our second fund, there's like, okay, like I'm pretty interested in, like, it, to your point, the valuations can be much higher on the coast. There's this sort of, you know, lots more capital chasing, you know, all the great deals, bidding up the price, you know, which is obviously going to drive down returns. You know, things were getting really expensive in the Bay Area. And you were starting to see, you know, instead of that sort of perception of like, oh, eventually you're going to have to move there, we started seeing the opposite. People were like, I can't take it here anymore. It's too expensive. I can't, you know, live here. I can't hire here. All my employees are getting poached by, you know, Facebook and Google. I want to move my company to Colorado, or I'm going to move to Colorado and start my business there. Or you're seeing, the talent wanting to be here. So you're seeing Google built a big campus in Boulder, Palantir moved their headquarters here out of the Bay Area. And so we've kind of seen the reverse trend. And so we've been fortunate to be able to grow with this market over the last decade.
So did you, so I saw a big migration from the West Coast to the Mountain West with the pandemic. Did you see that shift taking place beforehand, or did it really
Yeah,
start?
I would say it was happening before then. Again, Colorado, we're lucky here. It's beautiful, great weather. People who visit here tend to want to find a way to come back and live here. Me and my partner are both from the Midwest, and kind of once we got here, didn't leave kind of story. So I think you were seeing a lot of that already. And I think maybe something that is less true now, but kind of before the pandemic, there was a real arbitrage on sort of cost of living. And so if you were, living in a one bedroom bungalow in, Mountain View that was worth like $1.5 million, you could sell that, move to Denver and buy like a nice house that fits your whole family. That's still probably true to a degree, but it has gotten a lot more expensive kind of post-pandemic. A lot of, that sort of people, okay, now I can live anywhere. I want to live in Colorado, or I want to live in Texas where we have another partner. And so, part of our story is, when people could decide to live wherever they wanted to, they moved to Colorado and Texas. We're sort of the biggest recipients of remote workers during that time. And so it was definitely a big accelerant, but the trend was there before for sure.
Totally makes sense. See something similar in Montana. And I, probably another podcast we can devote to around just real
Right.
estate. But should we touch on geography? I'd be curious to know though whether or not you find that that's a conduit for certain industries that you guys end up investing in.
Yeah, I would say because we had a geographic focus, we took the approach of we want to work with the best founders in our backyard and took a little bit wider aperture on the types of companies that we would work with. And so we've been industry agnostic, and I think that served us well. If you look at the Colorado market, it's hard to sort of draw, a straight line and, through a theme where the private companies that are sort of billion-dollar companies, you have, Pax8 in our portfolio is a marketplace for big cloud companies to sell to the SMB. You have Sondermind is a mental health company. You have Guild Education in the edtech space. Ibotto is a recent IPO that was, consumer mobile app for coupons. So, it's hard to sort of connect the dots between those. And, I think it's an advantage in some ways. It makes our economy here diverse and the kind of talent and opportunity we have here diverse and maybe more resilient through cycles. But we want to work with all of those companies. And so if they're in our backyard and it's a great team, working on a big problem, we're going to take a look at it and see if we can get comfortable there, which, there might be a great team working on a big problem that we can't get comfortable with. Just we don't understand it and there's nobody on our network that can help us understand it. We'll pass, but we will look at a pretty broad swath.
So, makes complete and total sense, and I think it's great to be opportunistic in that regard. Curious if that's the same in Texas. And one of the reasons I ask is talking to a lot of your counterparts, if you find that oil and gas shows up in a lot of portfolios.
Yeah, I think there's it is generally true. I'm not as familiar with the unicorns in Texas, but they are, you've got some logistics winners, some consumer winners. You've had a lot of kind of space activity moving there with kind of SpaceX kind of setting up a larger footprint there. So, you are kind of seeing this diverse mix of opportunities. There's obviously a lot of capital in the state from kind of the oil and gas wealth, which I think to some degree kind of makes its way into venture, which is helpful.
Excellent. Well, with that, then I would love to unpack the scope of the first mile gets involved. But before we do, let's take a quick detour. We'd love to know your background and experience leading up to your time with First Mile.
Yeah, so I after growing up in Michigan, I did my undergrad at West Point and spent 10 years in the Army as a helicopter pilot. So a little bit of a long road into venture, but after, I got stationed in Colorado, fell in love with the place. My wife had started practicing law here, and we said we're just gonna stay here when I left the military. And she had a career, and I said I'll figure mine out. And it was 2009. The economy was kind of in shambles, and so hunkering down in business school was sort of the obvious choice. So while I was in business school, I met somebody who was running a tech incubator, and my wife's law firm was doing some work for them. And he's like, you could intern here in the summer and work with a bunch of companies on a bunch of projects and really kind of, figure out what you want to do after the military and how you want to focus your studies. And so I got exposure to a bunch of different startups, and the light bulb went off of, hey, like I'm a little bit older, going through my MBA. I think the way to sort of accelerate my second career is to, jump on a rocket ship startup and grow with it. I think I was a pretty naive on kind of the success rate of startups. In any case, I was working for a startup sort of part-time when I was graduating, and there wasn't an opportunity there. I ended up kind of going to work for a big company doing M&A and investor relations for a couple of years. I was super interested in venture. I just didn't see a path to do it in Colorado. The industry is still small, but it was really small then. Just a handful of firms, and none of them were really hiring junior people. So I thought sort of M&A work was the closest thing I could do, kind of making strategic investments and acquisitions, and that kind of deal making might get me back there at some point. And so after a couple of years, I was looking for at the big company, I was looking for a path back to venture and startups, and thinking I would find sort of an ops or finance role in a smaller, faster growing company. And that's when I got connected to my partner Bill, who was kind of thinking out loud about growing his personal investing into a firm and would need somebody to help him. And somebody I had volunteered for in business school was like, hey, I'm running, he was, had taken an investment from my partner Bill as an angel. And he said, he called me out. He said, one of my angel investors is thinking about starting a firm and is looking for somebody to help him. And I told him you'd be great. And he put the two of us together, and we raised that first fund in 2014.
Exciting. Your time focused on M&A, key lessons that you learned, and in particular ones that you find that you take with you today.
Yeah, so I was working in the mining industry, which isn't, and one of the reasons I sort of left was, in tech, acquisitions can be very strategic. We want to move the company in this new direction, and how can we acquire something to sort of get us there faster? I think that's what I was excited about M&A. And in the mining industry, you're kind of doing an NPV on the mine model and seeing if it's positive or negative. It wasn't as interesting, but I was working for some ex investment bankers, so I learned a lot about kind of financial modeling and analysis, a lot of presentation making, and raising. We weren't raising capital, but we had assets we were trying to sell. We were I was part of the investor relations team, so presenting kind of what was going on with our financials to the capital markets, whether hedge funds and mutual funds and people investing in our company stock. It's a public company. And a little bit about negotiations too. I worked on a mineral agreement negotiation with a foreign government, and I was kind of on the team flying down there to do the financial analysis. So if we change this deal term, what does that do to our economics? And so it was a really good sort of couple of years with sort of deep, finance modeling, negotiation sort of experience.
Fantastic. Okay, so let's come back to First Mile if we can. Let's start with what's the degree that you find that you'll get involved with your portfolio companies after you cut a check?
Yeah, so kind of as the name First Mile implies, we're really focused on that first 12 to 24 months after we invest. And we're really just focused on helping those companies find product market fit, and produce the traction they need to raise a larger round of capital. And once they do that, we tend to step back. And that's partly how we manage kind of building a big portfolio with a small team. There's only three partners, and that's it. And we'll do 30, 35 deals per fund. But we are, offering sort of one-on-one partner support to those companies. And so there is no sort of like formula. It's like, if I do this, then I'll get this and I can do that. And then I get to Series A. There's general playbooks and rules of thumb, but every company is different. And in, a startup by definition is, an experiment where you have to test things and see if they work and double down on the things that are working. And so we really try to help our companies figure out what is the right milestone to shoot for the next round. And then we can help sort of diagnose, are we on track or not? And if we're not on track, why? Is it a product issue? Is it a sales issue? Are we not even selling it to the right people issue? So kind of diagnosing, if we're not seeing product market fit come together, why is that? And making introductions, helping find talent, helping find customers when we can, anything we can do to sort of help them along that journey to product market fit is where we focus.
That's interesting. One of the thoughts I was, for the benefit of our audience who may not be familiar with aviation and the role of a pilot before you take off, you have a pre-flight checklist, and it's crucial and core to flight operations. And, there's a part of me that's curious, it's like I agree, total agreement that every company is different, but there are patterns. And I, curious to hear whether or not, you found that in certain instances, whether it's sales, marketing, or product development, where there is this concept of you see a pattern of a playbook. There's definitely things that I know are on the checklist that we have to address. And if they are, what are some of the big ones that come to mind?
Yeah, I think just given the stage that we invest, a very common sort of problem, phase that we go through is that transition from we've got a small team of founders, focused on building a product, getting those initial sales. Usually it's the CEO who's doing the selling at that stage. And I think there's often a temptation to kind of get that off their plate if they're not a natural salesperson and they want to hire a salesperson to go do sales and kind of build, eventually to scale, you need to build a sales organization. But that transition is very kind of delicate in terms of when do you hire your first sort of sales resource and what is that resource where, I think a founder, they may not love doing sales, but the feedback that they get by getting in front of a customer and hearing what message resonates with them, are they going to buy? If they don't buy, why? What is their reason for not buying? And getting that sort of unvarnished sort of market feedback is enormously valuable when you're trying to find product market fit versus otherwise, it's just too tempting to be like, well, we built this great thing and it must be the sales guy's fault because they're not selling it fast enough. Where when they're hearing it directly, it's like, okay, I think we're maybe selling to the wrong people, or there's a feature that we need to add if we're going to get this thing to start flying off the shelves. And so that sort of process of founder, really nailing founder-led sales. And then, okay, I've kind of built the rough draft of a playbook. Who do I bring in next to help me? And then when do I actually bring in my first account executive? Do they need an SDR to support them? What do we spend on marketing? Those kind of things are, because we've done, as a team over 100 sort of seed stage startups, we've seen that go well and not go well, lots of times where we can provide advice on, maybe think about an SDR first, or kind of what is the next step there and when is the right time is something that we deal with a lot because we're kind of that market entry round.
So any milestones in particular that you find consistently pop up as to say, hey, we're approaching that transition point?
Yeah, I think when the CEO is selling and they get sort of like, I've got more leads than I can service, and I've got more deals in the pipeline where, it's more of a, I've kind of run out of like, I am now the bottleneck to growth. And if I had, an account, maybe like a sales engineer who can do the demos for me, then I can come in, I can do the first call, somebody else can take over the demos, I'll come in and do, the closing call. It's like some, you're kind of defining the playbook, and it's really they're doing the whole thing from front to back. And it's when they can no longer handle that volume, it's like, okay, they're starting to find product market fit, and we can start to spend a little bit more on sales. I don't have a number for you, but it's more of like the CEO is, is now become the bottleneck to sales, and they need support to help them. If they had more resources, they could sell faster.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant insight, and I would definitely encourage the founders and CEOs in the audience who are listening to this, as you, Aaron, I mean, your perspective mirrors mine, focus on top of the funnel, get to the point where there's, a steady stream of leads coming through the pipeline. And, until that happens, it could be really tempting to start, offloading those responsibilities to other people on the team. But, unless there's a really good reason, I'd encourage you to think twice.
Yeah.
Because, VPs of sales, they're closers. They're not AEs. And I've seen time and again, this desire to say, oh, let me just get my VP of sales. They'll take care of everything. It doesn't work like that.
Right.
Doesn't
Yeah, I
work.
think there's a strong temptation to do that. But like you said, those people usually, I mean, that really good salespeople can really provide a lot of leverage to your company. And a lot of people discount sales, especially from the engineering side of things. But you don't get revenue without sales. And so it's a very critical function. And those people are really good at what they do, but they often don't want to build the playbook. They want to come in and execute a playbook, generate sales, generate commissions, generate growth. That sort of nebulous stage when you're sort of drafting the playbook is usually a rough time to bring somebody in, unless you kind of find that unicorn hire that, wants to do all of that and has done it before. Then that can be a great fit, but sometimes hard to find.
I agree 100%. I think it also comes back to the power of networking, and taking advantage of the investors on your cap table, your board, and making sure that they're crystal clear of where you are and, leveraging their network to help find someone who's going to be a good fit. Love to do some forecasting, starting with some AI, reoccurring theme on the podcast. My position is it's an industrial revolution, though that there's, we're still a long ways to go. I'd say what? I'd argue we're top of the first inning. Would love to know your perspective, how you're thinking about it, how you make decisions on making investments.
Yeah, we like you think it's a very big sort of technological evolution that is going to power, not just the model companies we're seeing today, but a whole wave of technologies behind it. Much like, mobile computing or cloud computing and cloud storage. And so, we are, the model space specifically is, enormously capital intensive. I think that the round sizes are getting to a place where they're almost unbelievable when you hear the headlines. And so that's certainly not a space that a small fund like ours is playing in. We see really interesting opportunities at sort of the picks and shovels layer, where the first investment we made out of our new fund is a company providing infrastructure to large enterprises that have complex stacks of, data centers and cloud deployments and applications, and they want to leverage AI technology in their organization and use their infrastructure and their data and applications, but how they sort of manage that is a is you know enterprise infrastructure orchestration problem. And so this company is doing that. So it's not sort of building AI tech. It's like, okay, now you want to use it in your company. Here's the stack that you need. And so we're excited about that sort of picks and shovels layer, especially where we don't think it's strategic to the model companies. OpenAI just raised like $40 billion. If it's strategic to them, like they're gonna spend a lot of money to do it. And so we have to be careful there. I think the application layer is sort of the obvious place where we want to be playing. And I think there's, we are in this sort of like hype cycle where, we're getting lots of pitch decks where it's, AI enabled X kind of pitches where it's sort of like, the way we used to do it, but a little bit better and faster, which those generally are not interesting to us. It's more of the who's going to take, we kind of just use this example with our LPs, but if you think about a company, like take the mobile sort of computing revolution, you had a mobile computer in everybody's pocket, and then you had ubiquitous internet, and then you had GPS chips on those phones and cloud infrastructure where you could connect it all together. You could take those ingredients and create Uber. And that was a thing that just didn't exist before. It wasn't possible before that combination of technologies existed. And so, we have less of a sort of predict the future model and more of a we want to attract, great founders and work with the great founders in our markets that sort of what is the sort of Uber analogy for AI? It's like, okay, now I have all these other resources that were available, and now I have large language models. Now what can I do that wasn't possible before? So very excited about that, just the caveats of, things are hypey and noisy and expensive. And so, there's a heavy dose of caution as well.
You know, when I listen to that, is it fair to say then, as part of First Mile's due diligence process, you guys overweight the founder team?
Yes. I mean, we at the stage that we invest, there's generally little to no revenue. And so, we're not extrapolating a trajectory and just assuming it's going to keep going up into the right. We're figuring out, is this a big important problem to solve? Is this the right team to do it? Those are the kind of questions that we're grappling with. And the team is, central to our investment thesis when we make an investment and kind of their unique insights on the, the problem they're solving. And so as we were just talking about with AI, it's in general, I would say we like the sort of under the radar kind of sneaky big opportunities that, aren't attracting a lot of startup founders and capital. And so those can be in sort of, and those are not sort of niche opportunities. They're the kind of things that just, we've got a company that does, benefits administration, and they're focused on COBRA benefits. There's not like a founder in every Y Combinator class, thinking about solving that problem, but you find somebody who sort of understands it deeply and how it works and where the opportunity is. That's a very interesting opportunity for a fund like ours.
Yeah, makes good sense. So if we can continue on with the forecasting and something that I heard you say, and I would tend to agree, and I know it's been a conversation point, this idea of who's going to be the first, single employee billion-dollar company. It's conceivable, but I think more to the point is you're seeing, AI is enabling companies to increase revenue per employee to the point that, perhaps they don't need as much capital as they have in the past. And so how does that dovetail with your outlook for just venture capital in general?
Yeah, I think that's something we're extremely excited about. We just talked about kind of what kind of AI companies are we looking for, and I think maybe a better perspective is the one that you just raised. It's like, how can our more traditional software companies leverage AI? And kind of our as I mentioned, the founding of the firm, our thesis was, seed is now a new stop on the way to A, and there's nobody in Colorado doing it in a meaningful way, and we should start a seed firm. And we've seen this trend on sort of bigger funds, bigger rounds, higher prices. And, seed has become kind of the new A, and now we call what we do pre-seed. And, we think there's some, special magic about that sort of first check stage. And, the past waves of technology created this environment where, now you can use AWS and Stripe instead of hiring, buying a bunch of infrastructure and hiring, coders to write payment software. You can just spin those up, in an afternoon with some APIs. And, over the years, we've seen, rounds grow and company, sort of you get these big funds injecting large amounts of capital into these very early companies, which sort of defeats the purpose of seed, where, our whole idea is like we take a capital efficient team, give them enough money to go run their experiments, improve product market fit, and then we capture a big value increase when we de-risk the company. And so if you're funding those with large dollars, it doesn't make sense. And so we think that AI is going to kind of enable sort of this next generation of capital efficient founder that can take a small amount of money, generate lots of traction. And that is just very exciting for a small firm like ours that invests at that sort of first check stage. And we're seeing it already where it's not universally distributed across the portfolio, but some of our teams are really leaning into. We thought this was a post Series A project with, once we had more capital and could hire more developers, but now we're kind of thinking this might be like a weekend hackathon project where we can leverage a small team and AI agents to code out a prototype of this new feature that we were not going to do for another year.
I agree. That's the what I see is confirms what you guys are seeing, and I think you're in a great spot investing where you are. Aaron, it's been a great podcast. Before we wrap up, question I love to ask. It's fun. I think you may also be the first podcast guest who's got my next question that I'm going to start asking. Because I had a member on the team who was like, "Hey, I got a second one for you." But let me start with the first one.
All right.
I love reflection, doing retrospectives. You learn a lot. And so if you had an opportunity to go back to have a conversation with your younger self, however young you want, what would you share?
Yeah, so when I started in VC, as I mentioned, I had come from the military. I had a lot of leadership and management experience. And then I had an MBA and some business experience on the back of that, but I didn't have a lot of tech experience. And so when I started in VC, every deal I looked at, it was like, I need to really understand the tech before I know if this is a good investment or not. And it took a while, but eventually I figured out that at the stage that we're investing, it's really about the people, their ability to communicate, raise capital, recruit talent. It was this sort of set of skills that I actually was pretty well positioned to understand, given my military background. Being in sort of leadership roles and around other leaders in sort of challenging, stressful environments, trying to accomplish something with a small, group of people, looks a lot like a startup. And so I sort of, didn't realize the asset that I had to help sort of, the lens I could view these startups where, the tech is extremely important, but all of our best investments, I could understand what they were trying to do and the opportunity and get excited about it in that sort of first meeting because the people were so good at sort of articulating the opportunity. And that's just a skill set that, narrative, storytelling, selling, it helps you sort of get investment. It helps you hire great people. It helps you secure your first customers. There's a skill set there that is extremely important that has nothing to do with the technology.
Yeah. I joke with my staff. I said, if you would have heard the very first time I ever presented, You would have been cringing so bad. Fortunately, it was a long time ago, but to your point, I agree 100%. I think a lot of times it's a valuable skill, but people don't necessarily appreciate like anything else. You got to hone it. And so knowing that's the case is really valuable. Aaron, second question. So I got one of our production members said, "Hey, Christian, I got another question I'd like you to ask." And I agree with him. It's a great one. So I'm going to put you on the spot, but it's an easy, I think it's a softball question. I loved having you on, but I'm now curious if there's any other guests that you would love to see on the podcast. Anyone top of mind you can think of that I should extend an invitation to?
All right, I'm gonna have to think about that one. Are you looking for founders or investors or kind of all of the above?
All of the above, and I like the logic of the question because it helps me acknowledge there's so many things I don't know, and I'd love to, I think this podcast is only going to improve if I can start pulling in perspectives of people I wouldn't otherwise meet.
Well, here's so I'm not sure who the right person is, but the profile that I would be really interesting to listen to is this is something that we're talking about internally as a firm. We talked a bit about AI today and how powerful it is, and we are kind of trying to figure out how can we leverage it within our own firm. And so I'd be really interested to hear kind of practical examples of people, VCs who are leveraging AI in their business. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a VC, but what are the things that people are doing kind of to help them do their day-to-day job with AI that really has moved the needle? And I think you kind of have to force yourself to do it, because I can, rather than figure out how to do it with AI, I can just knock it out and be done with it. But then you're going to have to do that every time. And so what are the investments people have made in sort of building out a workflow with AI that have, maybe took a little bit of time, but has really paid off?
Done. All right. I have my marching orders. I'm
Okay.
gonna make best efforts here to flesh that out on future episodes. But with that, Aaron, thank you so much. If there are any members of our audience who want to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
So they can hit up our website at, firstmilevc.com, and there's a form there and they can fill it out. It'll come straight to me, and happy to engage.
Awesome. Good stuff. Aaron, really appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And for the benefit of our audience, Aaron Stachel, partner of First Mile Ventures. And again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators Investors Podcast. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag innovators and investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.